Greetings, listeners. I am Ethan McCurdy, and I'm here with Carla Golden. We are Top of the Noggin, that is N-O-G-N, which stands for Neuroscience Outreach Group at NYU. And we're bringing you the latest and most exciting breakthroughs in neuroscience with an emphasis on new studies, cutting-edge technology, and neuroscience and culture. Today, we're going to go over a paper published in June 2020 in Nature Communications titled "The Central Amygdala Recruits Mesocortical Limbic Circuitry for Pursuit of Reward or Pain." Be sure to stick around for when we bring in Dr. Shelley Warlow, the first author of the study, for some Q&A later on in the show.
In this paper, Shelley Warlow and her colleagues study a set of behaviors called maladaptive attractions. Maladaptive describes something that is not an appropriate adjustment to a situation or to the environment. For example, a panic attack, an unhealthy but understandable way of coping with stress, would be considered an example of maladaptive behavior. In the context of this study, the authors used lab rats and manipulated an area of the brain called the amygdala to induce maladaptive attractions of addiction and self-harm.
The amygdala, as we've discussed before, is an almond-shaped structure that's deep in the temporal lobes of the brain. It is an integrative center for emotions and is also known to have a role in memory processing. The authors knew that the amygdala can ascribe motivational significance to an object. That is, you might seek out a cookie because it tastes good and it gives you energy. Whereas on the other hand, if you see something near an open flame, you might not grab it because you know it could hurt you. In both cases, your amygdala has helped assign value to reward-related or threat-related stimuli.
A maladaptive attraction not only disposes animals towards stimuli that carry adverse consequences, such as pain, the level of attraction is particularly intense. So in terms of addiction, this isn't merely having a passing interest in cocaine. This is a particularly intense attraction where the individual is fixated on it. In fact, maladaptive attractions are more than double the level of attraction that you would see in ordinary individuals. In the study, the authors found that by manipulating the activity of neurons in the amygdala, they could drive maladaptive attractions in rats.
Shelley and her colleagues found that if they activated neurons in the central nucleus of the amygdala at the same time that they exposed rats to rewards, they could drive an unhealthy interest in these rewards. In particular, they could artificially increase the rat's attraction to either sucrose or cocaine when both rewards were freely available. They also found that they could incite maladaptive attraction to a painful stimulus, an electrified shock rod. In addition, manipulating the same region could induce an exaggerated fear reaction when it wasn't necessary at all. So, how did the authors do this?
When scientists want to study the role of a specific population of neurons, they can use a tool called optogenetics, which is a fancy word for using lasers to control neuronal activity. In this paper, the authors expressed a receptor protein called channel rhodopsin, which is a light-gated ion channel, in the neurons of the central nucleus of amygdala, although we'll just say amygdala from here on in, so that they could study the role of this brain region in maladaptive attraction.
First, the authors validated that their optogenetic stimulation setup could indeed activate neurons in the amygdala. Next, they turned to rewards. The authors presented their rats with a task where the animals can make a nose poke in one of two ports and receive a reward. For each trial of this task, the rat could either retrieve sucrose, which is a type of sugar, or cocaine by making a nose poke in the port associated with either reward. The control rats, which expressed an inert fluorescent protein, did not display any preferences. That is, they chose sucrose and cocaine about equally. In contrast to this, the rats that expressed channel rhodopsin in their amygdalas and received laser-paired stimulation with sucrose only sought out and consumed sucrose, and they ignored cocaine. Similarly, the rats who had their neurons stimulated and paired with cocaine only sought out cocaine and ignored sucrose.
This goes back to something we mentioned earlier. One thing that characterizes a maladaptive attraction is that the level of attraction is far greater than what you would see in an ordinary individual. The laser-stimulated rats were so focused on the rewards that were paired with stimulation that they were more than 30 times faster to initiate nose pokes to receive reward, then continued making nose pokes even after the reward was delivered, and they even nibbled around the laser-paired porthole more often, which is a consummatory action that indicates a heightened attraction to the cue.
Many parents instruct their children to avoid putting anything into a light socket or electric outlet because they could receive a painful shock. From what we can tell, rats don't like shocks either, which is why a painful foot shock is often used as a negative stimulus. In fact, researchers can even pair a negative foot shock with a context to train rodents to avoid that context or situation in the future. Here, Shelley and her colleagues asked what would happen if they manipulated the activity of neurons in the amygdala and presented rats with an aversive situation involving an electrified shock rod.
In this experiment, control rats expressing an inert fluorescent protein and experimental rats expressing channel rhodopsin in their amygdalas received a laser pairing each time they voluntarily approached the electrified shock rod. Upon receiving a noxious shock from the rod, the control rats, or the rats that didn't get the stimulation effects of the laser, learned to avoid it after just testing it once or twice. In fact, over the remainder of the 20-minute session where the rats could interact with the shock rod, the control rats would stay as far away from the rod as they possibly could and even buried it with bedding that was on the ground. In contrast, the channel rhodopsin rats not only expressed the rod an average of 5 times during the first session, the next session they went back 7 times, and then the session after that they went back 8 times. They even chewed the rod like they did the nose ports that delivered the sucrose and cocaine.
Like the control rats, when these experimental rats were shocked, they had a reflexive startle and a swift withdrawal from the rod, indicating that this was still an aversive stimulus. But unlike the controls, these rats just kept coming back to it. In fact, when the authors repeated the experiment, this time without stimulating the amygdalas in these rats, they also learned to avoid the rod and cover it with bedding, just like the controls.
The researchers next asked, what would the rats do if this rod wasn't so easy to get to? To answer this question, they decided to place an obstacle in the way of the shock rod, a large block that filled the width of the chamber and prevented easy viewing of the shock rod. In fact, the only way the rats would be able to get to the shock rod was if they physically climbed over this barrier, and they did just that. Unlike the controls, the experimental rats actively climbed over the barrier and touched the shock rod every single time. Once they did this, the researchers would pick them up and move them back to the other side, but didn't matter. They would simply climb back over the barrier to seek out the shock again. This suggests that they were motivated to get to the rod.
Did the rats want the rod because it was associated with the shock? To get to the bottom of this, the researchers asked whether these rats would also want another cue associated with the shock. This time, they used a sound that was presented every time the rats got shocked and stimulated. And indeed, after the experimental channel rhodopsin group of rats learned to associate that sound with the shock, they worked hard to hear that shock-associated sound repeatedly in a nose poke test over a sound that was just present at other times in their home cage. Compared to this alternative sound that was not associated with the shock, these rats sought out the shock-associated sound by over 300%.
The authors were able to determine that the brain circuitry being activated in the addiction-worn, shock-seeking channel rhodopsin rats is part of the mesocortical limbic brain pathway. They did this by creating maps of activated brain regions right after the rats were tested a final time, using a protein that is expressed in activated neurons as an indicator of activation. This protein is called FOS. The mesocortical limbic structures that were activated are known to mediate reward pathways. The amygdala itself is also connected to the circuit. The authors found elevated levels of FOS in mesocortical limbic structures, including in the ventral tegmental area, the striatum, and the substantia nigra. What this shows is that the central nucleus of amygdala recruits mesocortical limbic circuitry to help create maladaptive attractions.
The authors then determined whether they could flip the valence of the stimulation of the amygdala from being positive to negative. To do this, the authors turned to a well-known conditioning paradigm freezing situation where rats learn to recognize a tone that is a harbinger to an inescapable and painful foot shock that follows the tone. Once rats learn to recognize the tone, they freeze when they hear it, because they know something bad is coming.
The authors trained both control and experimental channel rhodopsin rats to associate a tone with a foot shock, which itself was paired to laser stimulation to activate the amygdalas of the channel rhodopsin rats. In both groups, the rats would freeze when they heard the tone. However, compared with the control group, the channel rhodopsin rats would freeze for a longer period of time if they heard the tone while they received laser activation. That is to say, stimulation of the amygdala magnified the freezing response and thus increased the conditioned defense reaction. This suggests that stimulation of the amygdala can both enhance wanting of a cue and increase aversion to a negative cue.
Lastly, the authors wanted to know what the valence of the amygdala stimulation was on its own. Would it too be attractive to the rats? To explore this, they paired one port with stimulation and one port without stimulation, and then they just let the rats choose a port. They found that all the rats, that is the ones that were stimulated during the drugs and the shot, were not equally attracted to just the stimulation by itself, an important control.
Altogether, the authors showed that the central nucleus of the amygdala, a mesocortical limbic circuitry, mediates the pursuit of reward or pain and helps regulate the valence of fear learning. Specifically, the central nucleus of amygdala recruits the mesocortical limbic circuitry to create maladaptive attractions. So Ethan, what did you think of the paper?
I don't know if this is the right takeaway, but when I was reading the paper, it was hard not to think about the human context of it. And in a sense, I kept going back in my head to the fact that humans engage in just a variety of risk-seeking behavior. And the example that kept coming into my head was roller coasters, and how, you know, roller coasters are terrifying. You're in these hunks of metal and you're flying through the sky. Like, why do we seek out these experiences? And I couldn't help but then think about, well, I guess, you know, our amygdalas place a kind of valence on this experience. And it was interesting, you know, in the case of something like addiction, you know, something like a roller coaster is relatively innocuous, but, you know, something like an addictive substance like cocaine or this seeking of pain, which one can maybe even connect to depression, was a very interesting behavioral study. What were your thoughts?
Yeah, absolutely. I remember in my behavior courses during my PhD in neuroscience, we learned about people trying to make these better models of addiction, because it's not just that you're in a room, you press a lever, you get whatever drug you're seeking in a real life situation with a human, but you actually have to go through obstacles to get these drugs. You have to, you know, face maybe like some kind of like financial repercussions. You're maybe hurting your family. You know, it's not all positive, like maybe it could be for a rat or a mouse in an addiction study. So I think there's these ways that people are trying to come up with these like real world situations where they put up these barriers to see if the subject will still try and fight to get that reward. So I thought it was very cool that they showed that part with the barrier. I was also really impressed by just how robust the behavioral results were. I think it was pretty, like, you know, in every measure of it, it was that they would work to get the reward, they would perseverate on it, they would even chew where it came out of, both for the aversive outcome and for the drugs. So I thought that was pretty compelling. It was also like very clearly informed by principles of psychology, I think more so than the other papers we've focused on. I think those have been kind of more like just neuroscience across, you know, behavior to and system. This is very focused on, you know, like nailing down what the behavior is that's related to this region. And that was very cool. For people who are listening and maybe didn't get a chance to read the paper, I would encourage people to read that, because there's more references to psychological principles. Also, this is, I think, the first time that I've seen activation of the amygdala and citing like the wanting of a cue that is associated with an aversive outcome, like you were talking about. And I think it's cool that we included this paper, because it shows another role the amygdala can play beyond like fear and emotion, which I think is what a lot of people associate it with. But it also has, it's also really implicated in cognitive functions, like, you know, paying attention to cues and making associations with cues. So I'm glad that
they're able to neatly manipulate that in the paper when they're switching the valence of a stimulus by using the optogenetics to target the population of neurons in the amygdala. So they're very very elegant in that approach.
Yeah,
as
and
well,
something I definitely want to ask Shelley about is, you know, there's this distinction between the rats working for the rod that's gonna then shock them, and them just being in a shock condition where the shock is associated with tone, and the latter is aversive to them, but the former is something that they desire. So I think just like that's so interesting to parse out, and I am looking forward to picking her brain about it.
This kind of, just to comment quickly on the chakra, is one of the striking effects, and definitely our listeners should go, we link to the paper and the notes, but you see they have these graphs that essentially just look like X's, because you see this total reversal of behavior. And in the case of the chakra, when you have the fact that the rats, rats don't like the electric shock, not only do they stay away, the control rats do their best to stay away from the chakra, the fact that they use the bedding to sort of cover it up, the experimental rats just go for it, and they can't be stopped. They climb the wall that you mentioned earlier, they climb the barrier, the researchers move them back to the other side, they can't climb it again, they're just totally addicted, and then they don't stimulate these neurons, and they go back to doing what the control rats do, and they stay away from the rod, and they try to use their bedding to avoid getting close to it. It's really fascinating.
Yeah, absolutely.
Shall we bring on Shelley?
Yes.
Shelley Warlow is a postdoctoral fellow at UCSD in the laboratory of Thomas Nosko. She completed her PhD work in the lab of Kent Berridge at the University of Michigan, where she was studying motivation and reward, which led in part to the paper we're discussing today. Shelley, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me. Happy to be here.
So our first question for you is something that we ask everybody who comes on, because we like to hear about origin stories. And I think a lot of our listeners are people who are thinking about going into science, so it's helpful for them to think about how people got to be where they are. So what is your background as a scientist?
Sure. So it's actually, not the most traditional background. I actually graduated with my bachelor's degree from the University of Washington with a business degree in 08, like right when the recession hit. So I started an entry-level marketing assistant job, and pretty soon thereafter found out I just really hated that field and started to take community college classes in psychology, and just, really got interested in behavior. And then very soon after fell in love with behavioral neuroscience. I joined a few psych labs after I returned to University of Washington, got my psych degree and worked in a biopsych lab looking at dopamine signaling and risky decision-making in rats. And then from there, I applied to and joined Kent Berridge's lab at University of Michigan, where I continued to look at kind of choice, addiction, motivation in general, and looking at how motivation is kind of turned on in rats, which led to the paper here, and mostly focusing on the amygdala. And after graduating, I moved to UCSD, as you mentioned, and I'm working in Tom Nosko's lab. Right now, I kind of made a shift. I'm mostly studying VTA heterogeneity, and specifically looking at the role of GABA glutamate co-release by VTA and its role in lots of motivated behaviors and potentially in bipolar disorder and depression. And I'm learning new techniques such as patch clamp physiology, which is very challenging, but has been a lot of fun so far.
Very cool. Yeah, it seemed very evident from your paper that you have a background in psychology. Has some part, role to play in the story of what does the amygdala do? And the way that we think about cues. So our next question is, what was the first question that you asked that led to this paper? What were you guys envisioning for the project before you started?
Right, so this was actually building on some earlier work that I and others in lab had shown in a couple of Journal of Neuroscience papers in 2014 and then later in 2017, looking at how this same kind of optogenetic stimulation of the central amygdala, but not the basolateral amygdala, can kind of induce this biasing of choice when animals are choosing between a sucrose reward and another sucrose reward, but we kind of paste this excitation on onto one of those rewards. And we're able to basically generate this intense motivation and preference for the sucrose reward that's paired with central amygdala stimulation. And then I extended that to cocaine as a reward in 2017 Journal of Neuroscience paper. And rats were way more motivated to kind of pursue this cocaine reward. They worked harder to earn it. And so it, you know, very easily transitioned to this question of, well, what about when the two rewards are different, right? They're not these equal identical rewards, but they are different in value potentially to the rat, and they lead to different outcomes. So the very next step was to really have rats choose between sucrose and cocaine. And it's a lot more challenging because you have to, you know, use a lot of different controls to make sure that they're kind of on an equal playing field before you really tap into this question of which one do they want more. And so that was really the first question we asked that led us to this eventual other crazy findings as well.
So one of the things, I mean, you show that stimulating neurons in the amygdala can turn these rats into sugar addicts or cocaine addicts. I mean, is there a type of real life parallel for how this could occur in nature as well?
Yeah, so, you know, obviously, right, we're not testing all of the addiction criteria in these rats. There's, you know, beautifully elegant papers, especially by those in the Piazza group and others, that really dive into all the addiction criteria but in a sense, we are creating this preference. And, you know, first of all, humans don't do drugs in a vacuum, right? In the natural world, they don't have access just to cocaine and only cocaine, and that's it, right? That's not, these normal self-administration paradigms don't really model all of the varieties of choices that animals have.
That's so interesting. Yeah, there's a whole panoply of drugs that you can choose from. So you kind of mirror that with the presentation of the two rewards.
We do, yeah. And it's also, you know, I think this importantly, I think, speaks to, you know, a big question in the addiction neuroscience field, which is, you know, why, you know, people engage in multiple compulsions. They do have abuse certain drugs more than others, but most addicts really are addicted to one thing or one compulsion. And so our question really was, you know, what creates that one preferred target above all other compulsions, behaviors, or, you know, rewards that are preferred. And so this kind of allowed us to do that, because if we are pitting the two rewards against each other, of course, you know, if we hadn't stimulated the amygdala, some rats would prefer the sucrose, some would prefer the cocaine. Other groups have actually shown that most rats really prefer sucrose, surprisingly, when using the same kind of task. But the fact that these amygdala stimulations kind of drove them to one over another tells us that that might be why addicts want one reward over all others when choosing in the real world.
The compulsion part is interesting too, because that was one of the things that struck me when I was reading your paper about how I didn't realize that as for someone who has a maladaptive attraction, it's not that they want it, they really want it. And you noted that, you know, it's generally over twofold more than what an ordinary person wants. And so that this is the, you use the word compulsion, and it really is that. And you're able to evoke that response in the rats by manipulating this part of the amygdala.
Yeah, compulsion is tricky. And I'm glad you brought that up, because this isn't the typical, you know, compulsive measure that you see when people are trying to understand addiction, right? Part of the criteria is using drugs despite negative consequences, right? That's a hallmark of addiction. And here, you know, it's not necessarily that, right? Because the target of attraction is the harmful consequence. So that's what I think made things really tricky. It was tricky with reviewers too, because they didn't quite know how to take that. You know, they're not enduring a shock to get a shock. It's, you know, in other words, it might be something like enduring the shock to interact with the cue that predicts this outcome. So, you know, it's hard to know. Some of our experiments kind of hinted at that possibility, but it's really unclear still.
And you showed that stimulating the amygdala during the time when the shock rod was present produced this maladaptive attraction to repeatedly interacting with it despite them getting shocked by the shock rod. And then also stimulating the amygdala during the foot shock conditioning paradigm increased freezing, which were like pretty different kinds of responses, right? So what do you think the role of the amygdala is there? And do you think that maybe the valence, the positive or negative outcome of it is being encoded elsewhere in the brain?
Yeah, so that's an interesting question. And, you know, to be honest, we didn't expect any of this, right? So a big, you know, following off of just a little bit of backstory, following off of our initial sucrose and cocaine findings in earlier papers, many people would come up to me at posters or at conferences and be like, where's the fear? You're turning on the central amygdala. Why aren't they freezing? Literally, multiple people have asked me that. And I would always go back to, you know, Dr. Barrage and be like, well, this is what people said. And they really don't believe that we can get fear in this lab because we're showing all these these appetitive, positive effects. And so that's kind of what led us actually to even using this shock rod to begin with, to be honest. We thought, okay, well, what happens when you pair it with something that is very obviously aversive, right? And surprisingly, we got this weird result. So then we were still on the hunt for fear, which is why we chose this Pavlovian fear conditioning situation, because, you know, given the vast amount of literature that shows that central amygdala stimulation paired with an uncontrollable shock in a Pavlovian fear conditioning paradigm leads to enhanced freezing. Whether it's enhancing the acquisition or the expression, it's there's multiple studies that show either or both. And so it was important then for us to at least test it exactly how others have and show what that, you know, what happens. Can we get fear? Indeed, of course, as you said, we do see this enhancement of freezing. And I think there's a few things that this is important for. So I think importantly, this was in the same rats that showed the shock rod attraction. And you know, in some rats, they got the Pavlovian conditioning before the shock rod. In others, they got it after. So we didn't seem to think that there was an order effect. I think it speaks more, and this is something we kind of speculated on in the paper, to kind of this situational factors. So, and others have posited that this might be the case in amygdala specifically, so that there's these kind of overarching contexts that dictate the valence that, or dictate these modes that can then be either positive or negative when you turn on the amygdala. And so the fact that the rats were able to kind of control their interaction with the shock rod and were able to localize it within the chamber maybe made it less of this overarching, intensely scary, anxiety-provoking situation for them, and maybe just a little kind of exciting. It's hard to say. I can't directly ask them that. Whereas in the Pavlovian fear conditioning paradigm, you know, again, as you know, they're put into this chamber, they can't escape. The shock is coming from this grid floor that's not localizable. It's everywhere and it's at unpredictable times. So, you know, I think that those things kind of play a factor. And then to more importantly answer your question about valence, I think that example really demonstrates that the same stimulation can lead to different effects. Not necessarily because valence isn't encoded in the central amygdala, but that there's factors that precede its ability to, or certain modes of the amygdala to be turned on. And then the second thing I'll point out is that it speaks to the idea of, you know, very specific cell types encoding positive or negative, or specific projections always being appetitive or always being fear projections, because again, we're turning on these same, you know, whatever the projections are, we're turning them on exactly the same way. And so it kind of opposes that notion.
Right, because you're doing the stimulation across central amygdala. That makes sense.
Yeah, and that is a big limitation in the rat specifically. It is, you know, who knows, right? We're not able to be specific to medial or lateral or downstream projections. But I will tell you that others in the lab have been following up on this work with our new CRH Cre line of rats. And they're finding some interesting pro-approach behaviors towards the shock rod as well. And so again, the CRH being really famous for its role in aversion is still, when stimulated, potentially being involved in the shock rod attraction.
That's so interesting. I always think it's really exciting when brain regions act beyond these, like, you know, little like boxes that we've given them. Of, like, you know, people are like, where's the fear? Like, I think of amygdala, I think of fear. But yeah, they can play some new roles. I also think it's really interesting what you said about control. I had not thought about that. And like, you know, with the shock rod, they don't really have anything else going on. Like that's just kind of, it's only available thing to interact with. So.
Yeah, it's funny. When I was writing my dissertation, I came across this wild set of experiments that people in Canada are doing with humans. And they find, it's bizarre, and I'm probably not going to do the papers much justice, but there's this large set of literature from this one group that show that when people are bored, they will endure these shocks willingly.
Exactly. Yeah. So interesting.
It's odd.
And bored. Yeah.
Yeah.
One of the things we were wondering about, though, is whether or not there are potential, you see that there are potential clinical implications for your work? I mean, particularly maybe a therapeutic intervention.
Yeah, I think, you know, the most immediate implication, you know, whether I like it or not, is kind of self-harm behavior. You know, I don't have this is not my field. I don't have an exact reason why that is, but I think it speaks to self-harm and potentially kind of compulsive behaviors. You know, knowing the outcome is unpleasant, but wanting it anyway. Most people, when reading up on this subject, most people kind of explain self-harming behavior as kind of a coping mechanism. This might provide an alternative kind of argument or alternative theory in that there's some kind of incentive salience attribution to, again, wanting what hurts, not actually to be hurt. Again, whether I like it or not, one of my committee members, I think, jokingly commented on this as a model of masochism. I don't know if he's right or wrong, but it definitely brings that to mind. And in terms of therapeutic targets, you know, I think the amygdala has been widely studied in addiction and obviously affective neuroscience. And it is conceivable that this hyperactive, activated amygdala, definitely occurs in addiction and might be occurring in other compulsive motivations. So being a therapeutic target for these kinds of things, turning it off or lowering its activity is a possibility too.
You've already mentioned a few surprising things along the way, but was there anything else that surprised you while you're doing the research for this paper?
I think, yeah, as I mentioned, you know, to be honest, the shock rod attraction itself was so surprising. Erin Nafziger, the co-author, you know, she's a graduate student in the lab, and we kind of had started some of these pilot experiments with the shock rod. In fact, we pulled it out because others in the lab have shown that using the shock rod, this shock rod reliably induces defensive anti-predator treading. And so we thought, for sure, this is how we're going to get the CEA fear, right? We're going to use this, all rats tread. reliably, right? And, you know, if you've seen the video on the website with the paper, it's very apparent and robust, and it happens almost immediately after they get their shock. And so I think that first day was just so surprising because, you know, I like to show Dr. Barrage our data as we're getting it so we can kind of decide what to do while the rats are, you know, around. And, you know, I had to go to him and be like, yeah, they're not treading. They're doing this weird thing. Like they keep shocking themselves and now they're chewing on it and then they keep going. And, you know, and so that I think was the most surprising. Obviously the fact that they then flipped to show fear in the Pavlovian setting was, again, very surprising. Beyond that, I think getting the rats to prefer cocaine when paired with amygdala stimulation was also surprising. I thought for sure, based on previous use of this particular choice task, that all my rats would prefer the sucrose no matter what. And showing that, because others have shown that it's a pretty potent reinforcer in rats over cocaine. And getting them to even prefer the cocaine over the sucrose was very surprising for us.
So this is switching gears just a little bit, but a lot of our listeners are either in grad school or maybe some of them are thinking about applying for grad school, but people are wondering about postdocs and you know, career advice. And I was wondering whether or not there was anything that you wished you knew when you were, say, either first applying for grad school or when you were applying for postdocs.
Yeah, so many things. I had no idea what I was doing when I first joined labs. As I mentioned, I had a business background. I am also a first generation college student, so no one in my family has even been to college. They all stopped at high school. So all those weird networking things that people don't really tell you that you're just supposed to magically know. I think I had some opportunities. I had people looking out for me and telling me, but then I also just had to learn on my way. I think the one thing that was amazing advice when I was sure I was applying to grad school was to just email the advisors that you're interested in working with. That demonstrates that you have kind of read a bit about their work. It is a cold email, which is weird, but I think especially if you're thinking about psychology PhDs, which is what I did, you get into the program if that faculty member wants you. It's not a rotation situation in most cases. And so really reaching out to that faculty member is super important. And for me, you know, I wasn't able to afford like to go to a neuroscience conference. I didn't have enough research experience to be presenting. So that was really my only avenue. And I think, you know, faculty members are used to getting lots of emails. So it's not crazy to email them and say, hey, I'm interested. Are you taking students? Those kinds of things they don't tell you you have to do, but it's such a good look, especially when they see your application and they're like, oh, this person, they want to do this project, or they've reached out to me. That's like, it goes a long, long way. And it's the reason I got into grad school. I emailed Dr. Barrage and told him, you know, my background, CV and all of that. The other thing I didn't know entirely until I started thinking about PhD programs is that they're paid for most of the time, which is so cool. So, you know, in undergrad, I had to work full time at a restaurant in the evenings and then go to school during the day because obviously no one pays you to do an undergrad degree. But PhDs have stipends, and I honestly didn't know that. Probably the people listening to your guys' podcast know that already, but I think it's important to share.
So another off the cuff question here is when you are not sciencing, what do you like to do outside of the lab?
There's few times when I'm not sciencing, to be honest, but
since that's always the caveat of the question.
I know. I always am like, wait, I'm supposed to have hobbies? I forgot about that. But no, in all seriousness, I think I've, you know, really enjoyed moving from Michigan to San Diego. It was such like an uptick in my lifestyle, just exploring the area, trying new restaurants before quarantine. And then, you know, this last October, we bought a house here. And so, like, honestly, I've been, like, super boring and working on house projects most of the time. So that's about it. And just, yeah, like, trying to explore all the outdoor things that this area has to offer.
Yeah, I feel like after COVID, everyone's apartment or home is going to be very well decorated.
I know, that's the, yeah, exactly. Except for me, it's like caulking baseboards, you know.
Is there anything that you would like us to plug, like your Twitter handle and stuff?
Sure, yeah, people can follow me on Twitter. I usually tweet science-related things. So I think my Twitter handle is Accumbens Shelley, which with no spaces, so that's pretty straightforward.
I love that pun. We found your paper, actually, was on Twitter. So.
Oh, fun, yeah. See, it's worth something. It's where I find most of my papers these days, to be honest.
Same, because it's targeted. You're following the people you're interested in.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah, Twitter is great for that. And that's another thing I would probably recommend to those thinking about grad school, like get on Twitter. You don't have to post a lot. Just follow scientists in the field you're interested in because you will learn so much. And there's such a good community. It's really inclusive and active and you learn a lot. And I think it's a great thing for undergrads to do.
Yes. Science Twitter.
Yes.
Thank you so much, Shelley, for your time and for joining us on today's episode of Top of the Noggin.
Yeah, I had so much fun. Thank you for having me.
And thank you, dear listeners, for tuning in. If you like what you hear, please subscribe to our podcast and tell your friends about us. We also strongly encourage our socially active listeners to follow at Black and Neuro because they now have their own handle. Please also follow us on Twitter at NogginNYU, NOGNNYU. And join us again in 2 weeks for a discussion with Aaron Burberry about how changing the microbiome of the gut might influence and even improve symptoms of patients suffering from ALS.